Today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast, our journey is with a legend in the radio industry. No, seriously, Donna Halper is a legend. She's generally credited with introducing the greatest rock band in the world to American ears. You know, the massive trio from Toronto, Canada, Rush. I'm using them for my music bed today. But Donna's story is greater than one honorable mention in rock radio music history. Her journey is based on a fairly simple idea. No one was going to keep Donna from doing what she wanted to do, and she wanted to be on the radio. And it was a dream that began even before she got to college.
As long as you were willing to fit within what was considered normal for women, you could go to college. But if you wanted to be something non-traditional, like a lawyer or a doctor, people would try to talk you out of it. And in my case, wanting to be a DJ, oh my God, that was like not appropriate for women. But that's where my heart was. And I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I was willing to fight for it.
And Donna's victories resulted in a successful radio career. It took her to New York City, Washington, D.C., and eventually back to her hometown in Boston. But Donna saw the writing on the wall. There were changes coming in the radio industry. So she decided to forge a new path. And she returned to college, this time as an instructor, taking her years of experience in radio and journalism and passing those experiences on to a new generation of broadcasters and journalists. But she soon realized that she would need more than experience and a master's degree. She would need a little piece of paper to become a full-blown professor.
By the time I go back for my PhD, I'm in my early 50s. Now, if you've ever seen me, I'm still young and cute, okay? Most people do not take me for my chronological age. So I was kind of doing it differently, but there you go, I've always been different. And I finally was able to persuade a college to take a chance on me. It took me 9 years going part-time to get the PhD, and boy howdy, did I put a lot of miles on my car. But at the age of 64, in 2011, I got a PhD in communication.
Now, what's really fun about that PhD in communication, at least I think, is that Donna was able to take that lifelong love of radio and a love of history, and she put them all together in a dissertation about the history of radio. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by me, Ted Conte Jr., and Mountain Geek Productions. Thanks for listening. You can check us out on the social media, Twitter. I'm at The Mountain Geek, and Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is PhD, the podcast. Thanks for listening. It's episode 23. Donna Halper, thank you so much for joining in. As I mentioned earlier, she is generally credited with discovering Rush in the United States. They eventually would have been found. But Donna, thanks for the great work you did for the boys from Toronto. And by the way, that is Rush, YYZ, in the background. I knew eventually I had to have an excuse to put Rush on my podcast. As all of my unique conversations are, this certainly is a one-of-a-kind journey. Donna came from a love of radio, and she certainly is doing what she can to impart that upon her students at Lesley University in Boston. So I'm going to stop talking, and let's start shoveling with Dr. Donna Halper. Here, because I really just view this as a conversation, two strangers meeting in a bar, and I just happened to find out that, hey, you have a PhD, and I really like talking to people that have their PhDs.
Outstanding. I don't think you'd meet me in a bar. More likely, you'd meet me in a coffee shop. But,
well, that's yeah, okay.
I don't drink. I've never tasted alcohol.
No? I stopped I stopped 4 years ago. My body decided it was full more than anything. And I often say that I never drank coffee and I didn't smoke. And I say that that's why I never made it in radio, because I didn't smoke and I didn't drink coffee.
Well, now, see, I didn't do those things either, but I sort of made it in radio.
When did you leave radio?
Believe me, it was not my idea.
Right.
After the Telecommunications Act of 1996 completely changed the industry, I had been a small and medium market consultant for 28 years. And suddenly there were no stations to consult. The big six had bought them all up. So that's part of the story, part of why I reinvented myself and got my PhD. So are we rolling or are we?
We are rolling. Yes, we are rolling.
Yep. Okay.
In looking at your at a little bit of your resume and your background, you seem to have reinvented yourself a couple of times.
Well, you know, you do what you got to do. So once upon a pond in a kingdom far away, I was born, they tell me, but I don't remember. But I grew up in the 50s, which was a very conservative time, as I'm sure you know. And expectations for girls were, you know, teacher, nurse, or secretary. And I, no offense to those occupations, I didn't want to be any of those things. But unfortunately, the thing I did want to be, which was I wanted to be in radio, they were not hiring women. In fact, if you wanted to go into radio back then and you were female, that meant you could do a cooking show, you know, recipes and stuff, or you could, you know, do advice, the Dear Abby character, that sort of thing, Ann Landers, or you could do celebrity interviews, celebrity gossip, that sort of thing, Hedda Hopper, people like that. And I, you know, that's all very nice, but it didn't appeal to me. I wanted to play the hits. And there, unfortunately, were not any women playing the hits. There were guys that played the hits, but the guys that played the hits all had big, deep voices, and they all talked like this. And then along came the one person that totally changed my life, except he probably didn't realize it at the time. It was a guy named Arnie Ginsberg. And if you've listened to other stuff that I've done, you know, other podcasts or read stuff about me, Arnie was my cultural hero. Arnie was a top 40 DJ. He played the hits. I was a lonely kid. I was different from all the other kids. I wanted, you know, stuff that girls were not supposed to want to do. And Arnie just cheered me up, as a good DJ can do. And what was unique about Arnie was two things. Thing number one, he kept his name. Back in those days, if you had an ethnic-sounding name, and a lot of people talk about this with regard to Jewish people, but it wasn't just Jewish. I mean, if you were Italian, if you were Greek, if you had a name that did not sound like John Jones or Sam Smith, they made you change it. They wanted the names to be as nondescript as possible. And Arnie kept his name. Arnie Ginsberg was Arnie Ginsberg. And I thought that was incredibly cool. And then the other thing that was cool about Arnie was he talked like this. He had a kind of squeaky voice that broke all the time. And I'm like, my God, in the midst of all of these deep-voiced guys with nondescript names, there's Arnie. And he's different. And he's unique, and he's having fun on the radio. And if he can do it, I can do it. And that's how I kind of embarked upon the adventure of getting people in radio to give me a chance, which was not easy. So
and where was that? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Boston, and I was raised the first few years of my life in Dorchester, which is a neighborhood of Boston. Boston is a city of neighborhoods. And the neighborhood I grew up in was mostly Jewish. The neighborhoods in Boston were, in fact, ethnically segregated. There were no laws about it. It was just sort of de facto segregated. When I was eight, my family moved to Roslindale because we lived in a very small place in Dorchester and they wanted to have another kid and there was no room really. So we moved to Roslindale, and Roslindale was an entirely Christian neighborhood. So there were all of these Christians and us. And this was not a tolerant era. Okay. I know a lot of people like to remember fondly the nostalgic view of like, oh my God, everybody was so happy. Nah, everybody wasn't. If you were in the majority, you were great. But if you weren't in the majority and you didn't know your place, it was a problem, and it was a real problem for me being different from a lot of the girls of my era. And so I was, today we would call it bullied. I was mocked. I was actually beaten up and pushed down a flight of stairs. I was called a Christ killer. They were not terribly fond of Jews back then. And a lot of things would change. I would live to see the Second Vatican Council. I would live to see attitudes between Christians and Jews really get better. But I wouldn't see improvement in terms of what people expected of women. So when I went to college, I went to Northeastern University, and I became the first female announcer in the history of the university on my college radio station in 1968 when I was a senior. But I'd been trying to get on the air since I was a freshman. And people just were like, well, nobody wants to hear a woman on the radio. And I'm like, well, how many women have you had on the radio? None. Nobody wants to hear them. Okay. You know, catch 22. But yeah, I became the first female DJ in Northeastern's history, and somehow the Republic didn't fall. From there on, it was really hard to get a radio job. I was able to get some jobs writing. I did a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff, but I wasn't able to get on the air until about 4 years after I graduated. And I was able to get a job at a small station in Cambridge, which is about 3 miles outside of Boston, a station called WCAS. It played a lot of folk music and folk rock, and those were certainly genres that I knew something about. And I went from there and never really looked back. I ended up at WMMS in Cleveland. I walked away from tenure. I was teaching in the Boston public schools, and I've always been very honest about this, so this is not going to come as a shock to people that know me. I never wanted to be a teacher, okay? Now, people that look at me today and go, wow, but Donna, you're a professor. Different thing, okay? Very, very different, as I will discuss. But being a high school teacher or an elementary, nah, that was never my dream. On the other hand, health insurance, it paid fairly okay, paid better than an office job. And amongst the limited options available for women back then, teaching was something where they would hire you. So I was teaching in the Boston public schools while I fought for the right to be on the radio. And when I did get that right, and when I did get a full-time radio job, I walked away from tenure. I was going to get tenure in the Boston public schools, but it wasn't where my heart was. And so I walked away from it and went to work in radio full-time and never looked back.
There are a couple of ways that I want to go in our conversation, because you and I share a passion for falling in love with radio at a very early age. I got to live that radio dream during high school, college, and I worked in radio in and around the Denver area for a number of years afterwards. But I want to talk first about growing up, and for you, was it a focus? Did your parents put a big focus on academics for you, and were you expected to go to college?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's interesting because the society was changing, okay? But it was still changing in ways that we today would consider gendered. As long as you were willing to fit within what was considered normal for women, you could go to college. Like I said, if you wanted to be a teacher, a nurse, a secretary, it was all good. But if you wanted to be something non-traditional, like a lawyer or a doctor, people would try to talk you out of it. And in my case, wanting to be a DJ, oh my God, that was like not appropriate for women. But that's where my heart was. And I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I was willing to fight for it. But in terms of going to college, yeah, my father, God rest his soul, you know, in the old country, girls did not go to college. And he was kind of puzzled by it all. But I think my mother really persuaded him. And to his credit, he wanted the best for me. He and I never got along. I would be lying if I said we did. We were two very different people, and he was much more of a traditionalist in terms of gender roles. But once I got accepted to college, I mean, he bought it. He was proud of me in his own way. But yeah, the expectation was that I would be able to do what my mother wasn't able to do. My mother did want to go to college, but because she was female and because she was growing up during the Depression, there was no encouragement for her to do so. And I think deep down, while she understood and expected the limitations of her era, I think she kind of vicariously went to college through me. Because I remember coming home and sharing with her what I learned, not like, you know, people pointing their finger at you, you know, did you do your homework? No, it wasn't like that. It was like she was really excited to hear about the stuff that I was studying in college. So yeah, you know, in terms of academics, in high school, yeah, I was not real motivated. I, like I said, being bullied and made fun of a lot for being very different, as that kind of did not create a good environment. But on the other hand, I was always encouraged to read. I was always encouraged to learn. I had a library card from a very young age. I always loved books. I collected stamps. So there was always learning going on in my home, and reading was always really important. So yeah, going to college was something that I think my mother, more than my father, hoped for me. But once I got there, I really bought into it. It was like, this is great. I really want to learn new stuff. I was excited about it. Now, was I a nerd? Did I study all the time? Nah, not really. I really studied the subjects that interested me. Like, I was really interested in history. I was really interested in literature, those kinds of things. So if I found something, politics interested me. If I was really interested in something, then yeah, I kind of really applied myself. If I wasn't as interested, I did the best I could, but it wasn't really a priority. And by that time, yeah, my heart was in broadcasting, and I knew I had to go for it.
So your heart... Let me ask this question first. When was the first time you talked into a microphone and you had that injection of, wow, this is what I want to do?
Well, I already knew I wanted to go into broadcasting long before I talked into a microphone. Back in those days, if you were a guy, it was just assumed that you'd go to work at your college radio station. College radio back then was absolutely one way guys got into broadcasting. And I did not know, I'll be honest with you, I was kind of naive. I didn't know that the reason there weren't any women DJs in Boston, or in most other cities for that matter, was because nobody would hire them. Nobody would encourage them. Nobody thought women DJs was a thing. They didn't think it sounded good, which always puzzled me because, again, if you've never had any on the air, how do you know whether they sound good or not? So when I got to my college station, I was ready to do it. And I was utterly stunned when I was told I couldn't. I was told I could work behind the scenes. I was told I could do filing or, you know, work in the record library. But when it came to being on the air, that was a guy thing. So my first taste was actually just segueing records back in 1964 when I was a freshman. And I couldn't talk, but I could play some of the hits. I still remember the first song that I played was by the Kinks. I believe it was Tired of Waiting for You.
Hang on. So the guy is talking on the mic and you're spinning his tunes.
Pretty much. And there were also shows where if the DJ didn't show up, they would have people there that just segued records and played the call letters. You know, this is WNEU Boston. And then you'd play another record, but you weren't allowed to say anything. And that was so frustrating because I knew I could do it. And I just wanted someone to give me a chance. And like I said, it took 4 years before my rock and roll dreams came true. And in October of 1968, I finally became the first woman announcer in the history of Northeastern University. And like I said, somehow the Republic did not fall.
Do you remember when you fell in love with the music part of radio?
Oh, sure. Of course. When I was growing up, as I said, I went from being in a neighborhood that was pretty much all Jewish. Not that that's good, bad, or indifferent, but I'm saying that there were a lot of people there who looked like us, talked like us, went to the same places to worship. It was a very, what can we call it, homogeneous community. And Boston being a city of neighborhoods, if you were Greek, there was a part of town you lived in. If you were Italian, there was a part of town you lived in. It wasn't racial. It was pretty much ethnicity and religion. And I didn't realize, you know, a fish doesn't realize they're in water. I didn't realize I was living in a Jewish neighborhood. I never thought that much about it. I just knew that there were a lot of people who spoke Yiddish, and a lot of people went to synagogue, and a lot of people observed Jewish holidays, and I'm just a kid, so there you go. When I was little, my parents were very big music fans, so we had a lot of music in the house in terms of listening to the radio and in terms of playing phonograph records. I grew up exposed to big band. I got exposed to a lot of Yiddish music, which is the language of European Jewish people. I was raised in a bilingual home. When my parents didn't want me to understand what they were saying, they would start talking Yiddish. And I, of course, learned it in self-defense. Didn't tell them I learned it. So when they were talking about me, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, thank you, all right. But when we moved to Roslindale, and when we went from being in the majority in terms of everybody being in the same ethnic group or the same religion or the same culture, and there we were in Roslindale, where everyone was Catholic. Most of the people there were Irish, a few Italians, but mostly Irish. And then there was us. And like I said, it was not a great time for tolerance. I mean, people were okay with us. They knew we were Jewish, but we were sort of the neighborhood curiosity in a way. People were friendly. People were cordial, but they had their own little customs and they had their culture. And there we were. So I was a lonely kid to begin with. And being different from the other girls of my era was, you know, kind of exacerbated the problem, because while the girls were supposed to like makeup, I never did. Girls were supposed to like shopping. I shop when I have to, but it's kind of not something I get excited about. And I just, I was so different from the other girls in my school, like I said, that I got mocked and bullied a lot. And when I would come home, I would turn on the radio, and I had stations that I listened to, some of which were what my parents listened to, but I had long since found Top 40 radio. I loved the music. It was the music of rebellion. It was the music of, you know, Chuck Berry school days, you know, up in the morning and out to school. And I'm listening to these songs, and they really spoke to me. They spoke to me not just about school, but about loneliness, about the culture of youth at that time, the baby boomer culture. We didn't know we were baby boomers. We were just kids, but that's what we were. So I got attracted simultaneously to the DJs, who sounded like they were just having a lot of fun doing what they did, and the music, which was a catharsis for me when I would come home after another day of hating school and feeling different from everybody. There were four Jews in my entire school, and it was not a good time to be different. And I did not bond very well with anyone. So I developed a sense of humor, and I developed the ability to make people laugh, which is a good defense mechanism. And when I came home, like I said, My haven, my home away from home, the place where I felt good, was listening to my favorite radio station and listening to my favorite songs and listening to my favorite DJs. As soon as I could afford it, I would save up my allowance and buy 45s, because as I'm sure many in your audience remember, that was the music of choice was on 45 RPM records, and I had a whole bunch of them, and I loved Elvis Presley, and who didn't? And a lot of the songs just were such cathartic. catharsis for me. They were such an ability to sit there and go, yeah, that's exactly how I feel. And I just kept dreaming that one day I'd be the one playing the hits, and one day I'd find someone who would accept me the way I was instead of telling me that I was wrong to be so different.
You graduate, you're stuck. It sounds like, in your mind at least, you're stuck being a teacher until you get the chance to finally get that full-time radio gig. How long?
Oh, it wasn't just being stuck in my mind. If you look at the culture of the 50s, it was a very repressive, very conservative, very restrictive culture. Gender roles were really assigned. You were expected to marry young if you were female. Boys were expected to join the military. Girls were expected to, as I said, be teachers, nurses, or secretaries until they got married, at which point they were expected to leave their job and stay home and have babies. And that I knew from the time I was 4 years old that wasn't for me. Nothing wrong with having babies, nothing wrong with getting married. I'm sorry, I just knew from the time I was a kid. And nobody in my family knows where I got it from, okay? I knew literally from the time I was about 4 or 5 that I did not want to have kids. I didn't know that was a thing, okay? I didn't realize that in every culture, between 10 and 12% of the culture are childless by choice. In the 50s, everything was about marrying young and having kids, to the point where the girls, when you were a senior, jewelry companies, they'd give you like a hope chest for your linens, you know, a little right. replica hope chest. And I'm like, ew, none for me, thanks. The thought of getting married young and having babies, I know. Now, it's interesting because I never saw a career woman when I was growing up. I mean, the women I saw were either teachers, and back then, if you were a teacher, you pretty much were expected to be single all the days of your life. I saw librarians, I saw teachers, I saw nurses, but the culture was set up in such a way where many occupations still expected married women to quit their jobs. And I knew I wanted to get married someday. I was certainly a romantic. But I imagined an egalitarian relationship. I didn't have the language for that. I didn't know that was a thing either. But I really, in my dreams, I worked, my husband worked, and it was okay. And children were not part of the equation. I loved kids as long as they were somebody else's. But I was career focused from the time I was a kid. And the 50s were not a time for that for girls. That was just not something girls were expected to want. I don't know how I became so different. I just always was. And no offense to my mother, who was a wonderful homemaker, but I think she was kind of puzzled because she had long since made peace with the fact that she would not be allowed to go to college. I was furious about it. When I heard the story of her father saying that she couldn't go and basically consigning her to a life of doing office work till she got married, it kind of radicalized me. It's going to sound horrible, you know, saying horrible things. But, you know, I said to myself, first of all, no offense, but no guy is ever going to tell me I can't go to college. And second of all, I'm not going to be told that I can't go into the career of my choice. I grew up in an era where you didn't choose your career. Your career chose you. And if you were female, your choices were pretty limited. And that just was not, I didn't expect to be a radical. I didn't expect to be a feminist. I didn't expect to be any of these things. I didn't even know from these things. I just knew where my heart was. And I decided to follow my heart. And I didn't realize that I would be a trailblazer, a pathbreaker. I never thought of it. I just knew that I wanted to be a broadcaster.
How did you convince you said it was WCAS?
Convincing the folks at my college station were, that was the hard part too. I mean, it took 4 years before they finally decided to let me on the air.
That's just browbeating college boys.
It was still brutal. They really did not want women on the air. Right. By the late 60s though, the society is changing.
Right.
you're getting the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the gay rights, all of these things are happening. And I find that there are some women that are going on the air. Now, at the time, I don't know this. At the time, I was not thinking of writing a book. You know, let me very quickly plug my book, Invisible Stars, A Social History of Women in American Broadcasting, which the second edition came out in 2014, revised and expanded. But at the time, I didn't think that there were other women on. I didn't know other women on the air. The only women I heard in Boston were the ones doing the cooking show or doing the, quote, women's show. Gradually, more women get on the air in Boston, and gradually they get on the air in other cities. But I didn't know there had been women on the air in the 20s and a few in the 30s and some in the 40s. I didn't know. And when I found those things out, I became convinced that I had to tell their stories. But at the time, in 1968, when I first got on the radio, I didn't know it was a radical act. I was just like, I just want to play the hits. You know, can I play the hits? And by that time, it's album rock. So I'm also playing the album tracks and doing some of the stuff that protested the war and protested some of the bigotries of society. But how I persuaded someone to let me on the air professionally was a very long story of kind of, I guess, wearing someone down, plus the weather played a role in it. There was, as I remember it, a really, really bad storm, and my local station, the DJ, couldn't get there, but I could, and I offered to come in and play records, and I had a pretty large collection. However, it really happened, and again, when these things are happening, you're not thinking, oh my God, I think I'm going to be a pioneer. I better remember this. I can't tell you when I first went on the radio. I remember that it was in 1973. My recollection, it was winter, but that may not be accurate. But all I know is that in early 1973, I'm finally able to work in radio. It's not really a full-time gig because the station I work at is a daytimer, so it's off the air at sundown, but I'm teaching in the Boston public schools, and that's where I'm making my money to pay the bills, and I'm working in the afternoon at WCAS in Cambridge, and it was kind of like a dream come true for me.
How did you end up in Cleveland?
Totally by accident. As these things often go, fate took a hand in it. The program director of WMMS in Cleveland, John Gorman, he was from Boston. And as the story was told to me, he was home visiting his relatives. And he was, you know, spinning the dials and listening around. And he heard me on WCAS. And they needed another woman DJ. They had one named Debbie, and she was doing mornings. They may have had a second one. I don't recall because I wasn't at WMMS at the time. But however you slice it, he heard me on the radio. He liked what he heard, and he called me up and basically offered me a job sight unseen. And that's when I shocked my family and shocked the folks of the Boston public schools and went to Cleveland to follow my dream.
What was your first slot in Cleveland? Do you remember?
I believe that I was set up to be doing weekends and music directing. That was the other thing. From the time I was in college, I was a music director. And it was a job that I really loved, okay? Because I loved the music. It was great to listen to the new songs before anybody got to hear them and help decide which songs were going to be on the air. So I was a college music director. And then when I was at WMMS, I was hired to be a music director. And I'd already made some very good contacts over the years in the music industry. I had good access to getting new music. This is the era long before downloads, when people are getting their songs from record promoters. They're getting them from imported copies. The imported copies were basically shipped in, and you were really excited about getting them because the British version might be different from the American version. And it was just a really exciting time to be there. So yeah, I was hired to do an air shift, but also to be the music director.
So, Donna, I first became aware of you thanks to the documentary Rush Beyond the Lighted Stage. I'm a huge Rush fan. I can point
as
to
am
the,
I.
Yes. And I'm sure someone eventually would have played the record and Rush would have gotten what they deserve. But you are the one that that is seen as opening the door in America to Rush. What that period in music is profound for me, as you know, a lot of you know the world. What was it about music radio at that time that you found to be so invigorating and driving you?
Well, there was a freedom to play songs that you believed in. People ask me all the time, okay, I always, whenever I do a speaking engagement, and I do a lot of them, people will come up to me like, hey, could you discover my band the way you discovered Rush? And the answer is sadly no. Not because your band isn't great or wonderful, but the industry has changed so much, and to some degree, not for the better. And I'm not looking back on it with nostalgia. Right. It's not kind of like, oh, wow, things were great in the old days. No, they weren't. There were a lot of things in the old days that weren't so great. But what was great was that stations like WMMS could take a chance on new music. I got, as everybody who's a Rush fan knows, I got sent a copy of this homegrown record on a label called Moon Records. And it was by these three guys from Canada that nobody in the States had ever heard of, as far as I know. And a record promoter friend of mine, back to the thing I was talking about, like I made a lot of friends that were record promoters. A record promoter friend of mine named Bob Roper from A&M of Canada. He sent me down this record and he said, basically, we're not going to sign them, okay? We just kind of feel like they're not ready for prime time. But he said, I heard something on this record, and you've got good ears. You can pick a hit. You know good songs. We've worked together. Give them a listen and tell me what you think. And I was looking for a song that would speak to the audience. I was also, and this is widely misinterpreted, and it just irritates me that to this day it's still misinterpreted. I was looking for a bathroom song, not because I had to go to the bathroom, I did not, but long songs back then were jokingly called bathroom songs, because if a DJ was on the air at night and they were alone and nature called, you had to put on a record and hope for the best. And if you had a long record, you could get to the restroom and get back and nobody would be the wiser.
And 3 minute and 30 second songs don't allow you to do that.
Absolutely. So, in fact, this is one of the differences between Top 40 and album rock, where Top 40 played the 3 minute and 30 second or less version of the song. FM played log versions. This was one of the things we did. We didn't talk over the record, and we also played the long version. So I'm already looking for a long song, but it can't just be any long song. It can't be a piece of garbage. It has to be something that's a really good song. Oh, and by the way, it's long. So when I dropped the needle on Working Man, which is more than 7 minutes long, it was the lyrics that attracted me. It could have been a 3 minute record, but the lyrics, I just knew it would speak to Cleveland. Cleveland, as I've said on many occasions, Cleveland back then was a factory town. You had Republic Steel, which was the big industry. The sky at night would be like orange with pollution. It was definitely a kind of a gritty town. And yes, there were colleges there, and yes, there was culture, but it was a factory town. And when I heard the lyrics to Working Man, this is one of the differences, like I said. Back then, there was no limitation. It was, you heard a song, you thought it would be the right song for your audience, you just took it to the DJs and said, hey, you know, here's this great song, give it a spin. And that's what happened with Working Man. Will I get up at 7? Yeah. Go to work at 9. Got no time for living. Yes, I'm working all the time. I just knew that would resonate. Just like from the time I was a kid, certain lyrics resonated with me. I knew this would resonate with the audience. And when I brought it downstairs to the DJ and he played it, it's exactly what happened. The phones lit up and the rest is, as they say, history, because that started Rush's career in the United States. And I called their management, became friends with them, letting them know they were getting airplay in Cleveland, of all places. And it kind of went from there. So, yeah, I'm sort of acknowledged as the person who discovered Rush in the States. I absolutely was, I guess, instrumental in getting their career going. But if their music hadn't resonated with the audience, it wouldn't have mattered. As a music director, that's what I did. I exposed the audience to what I thought were great songs. And so did my boss. So did John Gorman. So did the DJs. We had a lot of freedom to take those chances. And it was fun, and it was exciting, and it was adventuresome. And sometimes it worked. Sometimes we would fall in love with a song, and nobody else did. There was a joking name for those songs back in those days. They were called turntable hits. And a turntable hit was a song that the DJs loved it, and we played it to death, and nobody cared. Right. But this was not a turntable hit. This was one of those rare cases where we got behind a record, or in this case, at first I did, and then other people kind of came along, and they got into it too. But the audience loved that record. And then when we started playing other songs, they loved those. And then when Rush put out another album, they loved that. And so on, over 43 plus years of friendship with this band and with the guys in it. And one of the things I am the proudest of as both a music director and a radio DJ was what I did to help a band from Canada to become well-known and to give them the chance so that the audience could like them.
I think that you see that in some respects, and we could, I don't want to go off on this tangent, but that in some respects is happening again today, thanks to public radio stations that are now more focused on music. They're filling that niche that has gone away as a result of the consolidation of the big media outlets. I mean, here in Denver, we're lucky enough to have two public radio stations that are offshoots of big public radio news stations that just play music, new music, old music, all sorts of stuff. And so in that, as much as we can have a return of that late 60s, 70s album rock era, we're fortunate enough to have it again here. And I think,
and there are some, forgive me for interrupting you, but I did a series of articles on, for a publication called Radio World. And in it, I focused on some stations that are alive and local, and there are still some stations in the United States, including 91X out in San Diego, that have been doing this for years, just like we did it at WMMS, playing new music and exposing artists to new songs, and they're a commercial station, and yet they're wildly successful.
Yeah, absolutely. How long did you stay in Cleveland?
Almost 2 years. And I have never lied about the fact that I was really unhappy and I could not get out of there fast enough. The one thing that I enjoyed was discovering bands like Rush and some other bands like the Sensational Alex Harvey Band and a few others. There were a lot of people on the station who discovered bands. I would be lying if I said I was the only one. But I became really identified with Rush, and it helped me a lot. But otherwise, I was not real popular at WMMS. I didn't get along real well with everyone. This was the era when there were a lot of drugs and a lot of partying, and I don't smoke. I don't drink. I don't do drugs. I do remember the 60s. I've never even tried any of that stuff. And I probably came across to people as really judgmental and, you know, school marmish or something. But I just, it just didn't feel comfortable to me. It just wasn't who I am. And so there was a lot of animosity. I think that people expected that they were hiring a hippie chick, and they didn't get a hippie chick. They got somebody who taught Sunday school, but who also loved the music and who got into it for the music rather than for the lifestyle. So when I had the opportunity to get out of there, I left. I went to New York and I worked for a record company for a year, and then I was able to get back on the air again. And it was like that. So, I mean, today I'm friendly with some of the folks that worked at WMMS after a lot of time has passed. Some of the things that bothered you no longer seem as important. But I keep in touch with some of them on Facebook and etc. So, you know, we can talk. We can talk. Can we talk here? But in terms of us being friends at the time, I was kind of the odd person out, and I really felt that way. And I was looking for a level of acceptance that I just didn't find there. On the other hand, they let me do my job, and for that I'm profoundly grateful. So I was able to have an influence on the music at the station. I was able to discover some bands and give them some airplay. And then I left in mid-1975 and went to New York. And there you go.
How long did you stay in radio directly?
I've been in radio overall for almost four decades. I was on the air for about 13 or 14 years. I was a music director for just about that entire time. I was on the air in Cleveland, in New York City, in Washington, D.C. Then I came back to Boston. I did some air work and music directing there. And then I opened up a radio consulting business in 1980, specializing in small and medium markets. I did that for almost 30 years, 28 years to be exact. And then along came the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and suddenly I didn't have any more clients. It was the big conglomerates gobbled up all the small and medium stations where I had been training people and creating formats and doing all that kind of stuff. And suddenly there was nowhere left to do it. And I had to reinvent myself again.
What was that reinvention?
Well, I had been taking courses all along. Okay. I always, from the time I was a kid, I was always a reader. I always studied. I always liked to learn new things. And, you know, some of the courses I was able to take were for not for credit, but I would go to lectures. I was always interested in learning something new. And I had two master's degrees, one in English literature, one in counseling psychology. And by the time I got into the 1990s, I could see where the industry was going. Now, I was already doing some adjunct work at some of the colleges. There were a number of colleges in Greater Boston and elsewhere that taught courses in broadcasting and that taught courses in journalism. I had been a freelance writer for ages. I wrote for Billboard magazine in the 1980s, among others. And when the industry began changing, I had my foot in the door at a couple of the local colleges where I was doing some part-time adjunct work, teaching courses about broadcasting or about journalism. And I knew that if I wanted to be a full-time professor, I had to get a degree because I did not have a PhD. And they were perfectly willing to let me continue to be an adjunct and continue to teach part-time. But I was never going to get any benefits. I was never going to get a good salary. And I was never going to get the respect that came from having the piece of paper. I would be lying to you if I said that, oh, yeah, from the time I was four, I wanted to be a professor. Nah, not really. But on the other hand, being a professor was a lot more fun than being an elementary or a high school teacher. And again, no offense to people that do that. It just wasn't where my heart was. But being a professor, I was teaching students that were older. They wanted to be there. There was a different level of discourse. There was a different level of dialogue. And I said to myself, you know, if I got to do something, I could do this. I'm already doing it, although I'm not full time. I was at Emerson College in Boston, which is well known for broadcasting and for media courses and journalism and stuff. I was there for 19 years part time, but they would never make me full time. I won an award as the instructor of the year. Didn't matter. You didn't have the piece of paper. So sometimes you have to ride the horse in the way the horse is going. And I thought they should have given me a full-time gig and made me a professor without the piece of paper, but they didn't. And they told me that if I wanted to be full-time, I had to get the PhD. So I embarked upon a journey that led me to get a PhD. And that wasn't easy either, because by the time I go back for my PhD, I'm in my early 50s. Now, if you've ever seen me, I'm still young and cute, okay? Most people do not take me for my chronological age. And I've never lied about my age, okay? I really object to what I think is a very sexist custom, where when guys get older, it's like, wow, they're distinguished. But women are supposed to lie about their age. Well, no, I'm not going to lie about my age. I'm 71. That means whatever you say it does. But for me, it was like, yeah, here I am in my early 50s, and I got to get the piece of paper. But back then, there weren't a lot of people in their early 50s going for the PhD. Most people that went for it went right out of graduate school. They got their bachelor's, they got their master's, and then they went for the PhD. So I was kind of doing it differently, but there you go. I've always been different. And I finally was able to persuade a college to take a chance on me, which was the University of Massachusetts Amherst, which was 100 miles by car from where I was teaching at Emerson. And so it was that at the age of 55, I embarked upon a journey where I would teach at Emerson full time and, you know, teach those courses as an adjunct. And then I would drive 100 miles up and 100 miles back to take courses out at UMass Amherst and to do some teaching. They bartered me out some of my courses where, like, I taught a course, I got a course. I taught a course, I got a course. It took me 9 years going part-time to get the PhD. And boy, howdy, did I put a lot of miles on my car. But at the age of 64, in 2011, I got a PhD in communication, had a really good GPA. I only wish my parents had lived to see it, but I'd like to believe they were there. And when I got the degree, I held it up to the sky and kind of looked up at them and said, you know, I did okay, I think. You know, tell me what you think. Do you think I did okay? And I got the PhD when I was 64, got a full-time job as a professor at Lesley University, and I'm still there.
I love this dissertation because you have this love of radio, and you're able to take it. And from our conversation from earlier, you have this love of reading and history. And so you mash up this love of radio and this love of history for your dissertation. That is Neil Postman's Missing Critique. And I'll ask you about that here in a second. A Media Ecology Analysis of Early Radio. And you take a look at the history of radio from 1920 to 1935. What's the Neil Postman's Missing Critique? Tell me about that.
Well, I was a big fan of Neil Postman. Everybody's got favorite authors. I fell in love with Neil Postman. I thought he was very readable. He wrote, when I first found him, he wrote a lot about educational theory and about the importance of skepticism, of asking questions, and of respect for history. And I was raised at a time when everything was just about memorizing. You kind of, you know, the teacher said it, you wrote it down, the end. And that wasn't what Neil Postman recommended. He was a big believer in respect for the past, but not worship of the past. He was a big believer in listening and respecting what your teacher or professor had to say, but also asking the right questions and knowing when somebody was trying to BS you. And he was an early proponent of what today we call fact-checking. And I loved him to bits and pieces. I never got a chance to meet him, but he sort of became my cultural hero. And I said to myself, my God, this guy is brilliant. He wrote a book in 1985. He wrote 20 books, but he wrote a book in 1985 called Amusing Ourselves to Death, Television in the Age of Show Business. And it was just an eye-opener. If you get a chance to read it, it came out in a 20th anniversary edition in 2005, and I had the privilege of working with Neil's son, because Neil had passed by that point in time. But I got a chance to work with his son in doing the revision, the 20th anniversary version of the book. Some of it's a little dated, but some of it is just brilliant in taking a look at how a new mass medium changes the culture. And media ecology looks at how each new mass medium creates an environment, creates a culture, and it doesn't usually eradicate all the media that came before it, but it certainly changes them. So when I knew I had to write a PhD, I said to myself, when I knew I had to write my dissertation, how can I include Neil Postman? Now, Neil grew up in the radio age, so let's see what he said about radio. And I start doing my research, and nothing. And I'm like, this can't be right. He wrote about television relentlessly. He wrote a little about journalism. He was on the radio. He did a radio show on public radio in New York. Back then, I believe it would have been called educational radio rather than public radio. But he was on the air. And I could not find one thing that he wrote critiquing radio. And this seemed bizarre to me. And that's why I called my dissertation Neil Postman's Missing Critique. Because if anybody should have had some perspectives on how radio changed, it would have been Neil. But instead, he focused on television and how television changed the culture. So I decided that what I would do is take a look at how radio, in its formative years, changed society, changed the culture, and created a very different media environment from anything that had come before. Hence, Neil Postman's Missing Critique.
Now, I want to talk about the other book on radio in a minute, you have two other books on radio, the Boston Radio History and then the History of Women in American Broadcasting. But you have a real love, and with opening day less than, 14 days away, 15 days away?
Oh, yeah. I'm also a baseball historian. A lot of people don't know that about me. And by the way, I haven't just written two books about radio. I also wrote a book about the history of talk shows. I also wrote a couple of guides back in the early 1990s about different formats like full service radio. I've been writing about radio for years. And I write about other stuff too, though. And I was a baseball fan from the time I was a kid. Again, I was always different from what girls, according to the stereotype, were supposed to like. And I liked baseball from the time I was a kid. And when I got older and I was doing a lot of freelance writing, I had the opportunity to come in contact with the folks at SABR, the Society for American Baseball Research. And there was a wonderful guy locally, Bill Nolan, and he was editing some volumes for SABR about early baseball history. And I had the opportunity to write a couple of chapters for some of those books about the first American League team. The Boston Red Sox were not called the Red Sox when they first got started. They were the Boston Americans. And it had nothing to do with patriotism. It had to do with the fact that they were in the American League. And gradually they became the Boston Red Sox around 1907. But I wrote about that very, very first year of the American League. I wrote about the opening of Fenway Park. I wrote about how baseball was covered in the era before radio, like how did the fans find out what the teams were doing. I did all this kind of stuff, and it was a lot of fun. And then later, I started researching, were there any women that wrote about baseball or wrote about sports? And that led me to do a full-length essay, which your listeners can find on academia.edu, about Ina Eloise Young. I gave a talk at a baseball conference about her. Ina was a baseball writer from about 1905 till about 1912. She covered the World Series. Her work was nationally syndicated. She did stuff that other women of her era never did. She was just amazing. And I found some women of color who were baseball writers. I gave a talk about them at a symposium last year at Cooperstown, and that will come out in print form later this year. So yeah, in addition to being a media historian, I also have done some work on the history of baseball, and particularly as it pertains to women and minorities.
If I were at Lesley College, what classes can I take from you?
Well, first of all, you'd be at Lesley University.
Sorry.
No, but that's don't be shocked there that I corrected you on that, because decades, we were, in fact, Lesley College, okay? And that was the original name way back when. We originally were founded in 1909 by two sisters, Edith and Olive Lesley, and they were very involved in the kindergarten movement, which was the movement to professionalize kindergarten teaching and early childhood education. And at first, that's pretty much what Lesley was known for. But as society changed, you started having more options for women. And gradually, what had been a girls' school that was known mainly for training teachers and counselors, we expanded. We bought an art school and started offering courses in animation and cartooning and stuff like that. And then in 2004, we went co-ed. And then the Lesley College kind of went away because we were a university by this point in time. So a lot of people still think of us as Lesley College because that's what we were for like more than six decades. So I'm not really surprised that that name has stuck with you. But yeah, if you were at Lesley University, you would be taking me for public speaking. You'd be taking me for the introduction to journalism, introduction to communication, media analysis, media history, political communication, which I have a lot of fun teaching. I've always been interested in politics. And then I also now and then teach courses in English literature because I do have a master's in it and I still enjoy doing that sometimes.
People do come up to you and ask you about Rush. That's obviously how I connected with you as well. What new music are you listening to these days? Do you still have your ear to new music?
Oh, constantly. My students turn me on to a lot of new music, but I'd be very hesitant to say that there's something I'm listening to because, to be honest with you, lately, my focus has really been on writing and researching about politics and writing and researching about the changing roles of women in society. So I've really been focused on that. I still listen to, of course, I listen to the radio. Of course, I listen to new music. Of course, people will recommend stuff to me like, you know, hey, have you heard this band or that band, you know? That's great. I'm really, really happy to do that. But over the past couple of years, with some of the changes in our culture, my focus really has been on media history. And I just, the most stuff that I'm up to is about political communication and about media stereotypes. I do a lot of speaking engagements about media stereotypes.
Certainly important issues that...
And about the importance of fact-checking. Hello.
Yep, absolutely. I think that also these are important times that that we do need to be making sure that we're going back and checking those facts and really being skeptical about.
Well, the thing that worries me, and I think it's worried a lot of people, is confirmation bias. Okay. Confirmation bias, as I'm sure you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, is when you intentionally seek out sources that reinforce what you already believe. Okay. So if you already believe that Donald Trump is X, Y, or Z, or Hillary Clinton is A, B, or C, you're going to seek out sources that tell you, boy, are you right about them? Yeah, they really are. As opposed to trying to find out the other side. Or I developed a seminar at Lesley in thinking outside the bubble, learning to communicate with the other side. And it's been a very useful seminar because in many ways, it provides students with the opportunity to look at what's different in society today in terms of the way I think about the issues. Do I possibly have some misconceptions? Not like, can I win you over? You know, I voted for so-and-so, and boy, are you a dummy if you didn't vote for them. I'm not coming from that. I'm coming from, yeah, I voted for so-and-so, and here's why. But what can I learn about you that will help me to communicate better with you? My entire focus is on improving communication. It's what I'm up to. And part of improving communication is getting people away from confirmation bias. Oh, the liberals are this and the conservatives are that. And I heard a commentator who said that I'm right. It might make you feel better, but it doesn't inform you. And I really think it's important for people to be informed about what the other side believes. Not like an argument, but just like information. And when I did my book about talk radio way back in 2008, which I'd love to do an update of that book, one of the things I talked about is that talk radio used to be about presenting both sides of issues. It is a myth that it was only like one side, and, you know, boy, we were happy back in those. Nah, even though there was something called the fairness doctrine, even though you had to provide both sides of the issues, it wasn't immediate. It wasn't like if I say X, I immediately have to have somebody on the air who says Y. It just meant that both sides at some point had to be given the chance to be heard. And I think that's really important. And I think it's a shame that a lot of radio stations today have programming that is so one-sided because it misses an opportunity to reach out to the other side. I have no problem with people who voted differently for me, who believe differently for me. Just don't call me names. When I go on social media, that's like my first rule. I will debate anyone about anything. I just don't want you to call me names. I want to have a conversation about where we agree, where we disagree. And I think in some ways, radio no longer is, except on public radio. But commercial radio is very rarely the space of dialogue. It's the space of anger, shouting, recrimination, and a lot of confirmation bias. And I think that's a shame. I grew up in the last era where talk show hosts really worked on creating a conversation that covered all sides of the issues. Yes, you can still hear that on public radio, but I wish you also heard it on commercial radio because I really do think there's still a niche for it. I really do think there is still a need for radio that gives people the opportunity to learn about both sides, not like an argument, but like a conversation. And that's what I try to promote.
Donna, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. And congratulations on your transition from radio, speaking as an addict of talking in front of the mic. I can really appreciate it. And having escaped that and working in the insurance industry for so long, I can certainly appreciate the challenges in leaving the love of radio.
Well, can I just say one more thing,
please,
if I might? If you were in one of my classes, I hope I would challenge you. I hope I would make you think differently about some issues. But I also hope that you would feel respected. I heard a quote from Salman Rushdie one time, and it really stayed with me. He said, radio should be a space for thought, not a space from thought. So I try to create conversations about issues, about whatever, But I always try to encourage students to do the fact-checking, to come up with their own perspectives, and to at least be willing to learn from others that are different. Having grown up in an environment where it was not okay for me to be different, I don't want to be that person that says, you have to think my way. Now, I mean, come on, I'm not going to lie to you. It would be nice if everybody agreed with me. Wouldn't that be swell?
It'd be awful boring.
But it would also be, yeah, but that's what I was going to say next. It would be awfully boring. There's a big world out there. We got real problems. It's about time that we took the opportunity to learn to communicate with each other. And I hope that in some small way, my transition from broadcasting into education has created some good conversations for people. And I'd like to believe I've taught my students something. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a lot of fun. I still miss radio. I'm not going to lie. I still get to be a guest on people's shows. And it's fun being on a podcast. And I really appreciate that you wanted to hear something I had to say. I hope I didn't babble endlessly. And thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Okay, yes, that's more Rush in the background, Cygnus X1 Part 2. Donna Halperth, thank you so much for your time. Really enjoyed the conversation, and certainly yours is a unique journey, as all journeys are to a PhD. I've got another episode I got to put together. It'll drop in a couple of weeks, this time as a paleontologist. Also, I have some additional interviews lined up, another music historian, and another anthropologist as well coming as in future episodes. As always, I appreciate your time and thanks for listening. Please leave a comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And shoot me a note or make an introduction if there's a PhD out there in the world that you think has a story worth telling. Thanks. Have a great day. And until we talk again, keep shoveling.